Hi, this is Lindsey Graham, executive producer and sound designer of 1865. And as sound designer of the series, I'm especially excited to bring to you a special bonus behind-the-scenes episode with one of my favorite podcasters and a sound designer himself, Dallas Taylor, host of 20,000 Hertz, a podcast that explores the stories behind the world's most recognizable and interesting sounds. The podcast 20,000 Hertz, all words, no numbers, has episodes on the iconic THX Deep Note Sonic logo, noise pollution, and a fascinating episode on being George Clooney, featuring the voice artists who are responsible for dubbing all of George Clooney's roles into local languages across the globe. We're going to talk about sound, sound design, and how audio dramas like 1865 use sound in storytelling, and maybe trade a few tricks. Here's my conversation with Dallas. Dallas, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get into talking about sound design, I want to talk a little bit about your expertise in the area and what your podcast is. So what is 20,000 Hertz and why did you pick that as its name?
Sure. So I'm a sound designer by trade. Most of what I do are things like commercials for like Nike and HBO and Netflix and all kinds of TV networks. And so me and my team work on making those things sound amazing. And so I've done that for about 10 years. And in that world, you oftentimes find, or just blatantly obvious, that the rest of the world doesn't think much about sound. We had a lot of cool conversations about stories here or there, but it was just stuff that never really got out to the public. And so I'd been thinking about since really early on how to make a show about sound. And I was a huge fan, still am, of 99% Invisible. And occasionally that show would do shows about sound. And then I'm a friend with Roman Mars over there. And then just over the years, it appeared that they were kind of going very much into an architecture space and a visual space. And kind of sort of with his blessing, I felt like there was space for like a full sound show. And so I spent probably 5 years thinking about it. And then even before the first episode, spent about 9 months producing the first and second episode and really just trying to explore what the voice is and how we can tell stories about sound. But then made 20,000 Hertz. And so 20,000 Hertz, which in our show is all spelled out, is the upper threshold of human hearing. And so Hertz is a H-E-R-T-Z, that is a cycle. It's like if you push your speaker out and you pull it back in and then you get back to the middle, that's a hertz. That's basically a cycle. And the faster it goes, the higher pitch it goes. And so when we're kids, we can usually hear all the way up to the upper threshold, which is 20,000 hertz. And things like dogs can go even further than that. But we just use that as kind of like the title of something. It's just like the upper threshold. Now, as you get older, it kind of seeps down to 18,000 hertz and 16,000 hertz, and it's totally normal. But yeah, that's kind of what the inspiration is. And what we do is we tell stories about all kinds of recognizable sounds and really how sound affects your mind and your personality and your thought process and all kinds of stuff.
Quick aside, my hearing is not 20,000, 18,000, it's not even 16,000 hertz anymore. I top out my upper limits probably around 13 these days.
Yeah. Curious, how old are you?
I'm 45.
That sounds about, yeah. We did a show about hearing loss, and I'm the oldest one in the studio, and it was so funny because we were playing different frequencies.
Right.
And as we were going to 12,000 hertz, everyone was like, oh, I hear that, you know, 14,000 hertz. Everyone was like, 15,000 hertz, 16,000 hertz. Everyone, I think it was 16, and everyone was like, And then I was like, and I didn't hear it. And I was like, no, what's happening? And then we got all the way up to 20 and like, just, it was like by age. And then the person who could hear the highest was the youngest. So it's totally normal.
Well, it came to bite me because on a episode of American Scandal, I composed some music that, unknowns to me, had a huge spike at like 15K.
Oh, man.
And I got all this flood of reaction from listeners saying, what are you doing to us? This dog whistle in the middle of the podcast. So I had to visually search for which track was the offender and find it and repair it.
Especially in earbuds.
Yeah.
All right. Well, but you know, that kind of segues into my next question, because I'm sure your audience isn't all sound designers like you and me. How do you think 20,000 Hertz is relevant to a broader audience?
Well, it was entirely intentional that every story that we tell is very much in line with the general audience and not with audiophiles and audio engineers. Mainly because the real point of the show is to get the public really to fall in love with their sense of hearing again, and just know that there's stories and thought processes behind every sound that that we know in our culture. And sound in general, I always think of it as very much like the fifth sense in line of importance, sadly. You know, if we think about music, everyone has a visceral response to music. But outside of music, people don't really curate their sonic palette in their homes or in their outdoors or in their cars or whatever. But with our other four senses, we do it all the time, all day long. So visually, you'd be hard pressed to look in any direction of where you are currently sitting and see something that was not designed very meticulously by a human. Every direction, everything that we think about, we're very, 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 very visual creatures. And then you have like the sense of taste, and that's something that we all think about, you know, 2, 3, 4 or more times a day. We know what we like and we know what we don't. And if we don't like something, we don't eat it again. With the sense of touch, we have comfortable couches and chairs and clothes, and you know, it's a comfortable temperature. And if something's off, we fix it immediately. And so with smell, same deal. We have candles, we have colognes, we have deodorants, things that if you have a bad smell, we fix it, and we fix it very quickly. So we have four senses that we're very culturally in tune with, yet we have a sense of sound that is just as important, arguably, and we don't fix problems when something sounds terrible. We just accept them as that's the way it is. And so so what I'm trying to do with the show is really just start to just peek into these very topical stories. Some are very human. Some have like a beginning, middle, and end. Some are, here's this cool sound effect, like the beginning, like the Xbox sound effect. How was that built and how much thought went into it? And then some are like really on the bleeding edge of science. And so there's certain things like misophonia and ASMR, which ASMR in particular is a bleeding of your hearing sense that bleeds into your sense of touch, which is pretty wild. And lots of science, lots of very topical things. Some are funny, some are serious. And but with the entire intent of getting the rest of the world in tune and in love with their sense of hearing.
Well, let's talk about how much work goes into making something that is purely sound, you know, a podcast. Here's one element, one piece of media that has no visual component, no smell, no touch, nothing else, just sound. And yet, you know, like even though you and I probably work daily EQing, compressing, limiting, crossfading, luffing, editing out smacks and clicks and guttural noises and adding in sound effects and music, and we're just in general working really hard to make things sound good. But there are a lot of podcasts out there, some from large and reputable institutions that just don't sound good to me. Why is like production value for podcasts important? Why is sound important? Why do we ignore it so much?
Well, it goes back to that whole thing is that it's the sense that people just don't take very seriously. And if we translate like what you just said into the visual sense, like you can shoot something on a, you know, iPhone 4 camera and get millions of hits if it's incredibly brilliant. And so you can have people who are amazing talkers and people who have an amazing message that are poorly recorded that can have giant audiences. And that's you know, it's amazing that the talent and the thought and the brains that these people have. But it would be as if shooting a movie or shooting something very highly stylized. The way that I think about what you do is very much like taking our audio in the seriousness as any film would take their visuals. And what I do as any of the most stylized, high value nonfiction documentary style content if I take that as seriously as the documentarians would. That's kind of the way that I see what you do and the way that when what I do. And for me, with that, generally, and every story is different, but generally it takes us anywhere from 150 to 200, sometimes up to 250 hours per 20 minutes of content that we make. And that's the that's going into finding experts and booking them and hiring someone to go out and record them because they're all over the world and we want to get a great recording, to compiling that, to getting transcripts, to getting the writer to cut that down, to starting to build in narration and toying with sound ideas. Because on a side note here, the best sound ideas come on a script and not are shoehorned later. It's something that's very methodical. If you want sound to be very effective, you have to write for sound rather than it being like, here's the written word, now just make sound magical. So finding these opportunities, eventually editing it all together, crafting it in audio, crafting the messages, crafting the way that something's said, and then kind of like rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat. So we go through our script, our paper script, probably 10 times. And then we go through our audio version, probably 4, 5, 6 times as well. And then, to write it actually doesn't tend to take too terribly long. It's just really just like make something magical in sound. It takes time and it takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of crafting and it takes a lot of pacing and it takes dynamics and it takes processing of what you're trying to like, build in the theater of the mind. And, someone on our podcast at one point said that the best pictures are in audio form. And it's such a magical way of looking at that, because you, with sound, especially with the content that you make, you're allowing anybody from any background to come into this sonic world, and their background fills in the pictures. So they're their own art director. Like the listener is the cinematographer. Like the listener sees the faces of these people and they bring it in with their own experiences. So it's such an amazingly intimate world, because you give the visual palette to the listener's brain.
Well, let's talk about the input that we're giving to our audience's brains. I know in 1865, you know, if you start with a blank slate, a blank piece of paper, and you're, as a sound designer, you're told, okay, here's the idea. You're going to be getting some dialogue or, you know, a narration, and it's set in a historical period of time. It could be the future, right? It could be underwater. It could be on top of a mountain. You have a lot of options, and you have a lot of fights. Because obviously, for instance, underwater or at the top of the mountain, it's going to be really windy or bubbly or murky, or it's an environment in which hearing would be hard. That wasn't so much the case in 1865, because really it's just a bunch of people talking in rooms. I actually had the opposite problem. I had to try to force some feeling of environment into the mix.
Well, that's a question I have for you.
Yeah.
If you don't mind me flipping the script here. When you recorded these actors for 1865, are you recording them dry, meaning, you know, just in front of a microphone in a very dry room, or are you worldizing it and recording them in spaces?
No, we recorded close and dry in a dead room.
And that's what's so impressive is that there's a couple elements here that I'll just give an observation on. There's sound design, where you build out worlds, you build, you know, creeks, and you build wind, and you build all of these worlds. But there's another very nuanced element to sound design, which is dialogue processing. And the thing that I find so fascinating in 1865 is just how well you put the listener in the space of where the actor is simply by the processing that you choose. Like, you can hear the reverb-y rooms. And if you go into any old place like I've been in Ford's Theater and I've been across the street where Lincoln died and things, it's like it sounds just like that. It's very wood heavy. There's not a lot of fabric, so you just hear that old thing, the creaks and all that stuff. And so you do such an amazing job of just filling in the gaps simply by the way that you choose to process these very dry mics. And that was the first thing that just jumped out to me, is just how carefully thought out and beautiful those choices were.
Well, thank you very much. I can tell you that those choices came from just the terror of facing that blank page of figuring out what, how the F I'm going to do this. Because I really wanted a very real sounding podcast, without any stylized elements. So, you know, it's not a science fiction, piece. It's not on top of a mountain or underwater. I don't have the opportunity to put bleeps and bloops and lasers and things in there. So I decided to be very real. And what that entailed, and, you know, some more shop talk here, was actually finding, my director's house here. He actually lives only two blocks from the studio, was built turn of the century. So probably 40 years after 1865, maybe 50. But I had this one or two evenings available in which the house was empty and available to me, to just record in. So we turned off the AC, we turned off the fridge, anything that made noise. And, I just recorded the rooms. We recorded, of course, you know, footsteps and doors opening and closing and walking down halls and all the bits, but also people just being in a place and turning and their clothes shifting a little bit. And then I ran, I took a, you know, I shot the room with, you know, convolutional
reverb,
in different angles. And so that house kind of became our set. You know, one room became Stanton's office, one room in a particular orientation became, you know, the Peterson house or the Oval Office. And, I didn't expect to be as difficult and arduous as it was, but, I had in the end, too much audio, but I went through it and, you know, that's the authenticity that you're hearing. It was meticulous.
And even someone like me with a keen ear that does this all day, you know, even asking you earlier, did you worldize this versus did you record it in front of a dry mic? Because I was tricked on that, and I'm almost never tricked on stuff like that. So for me, it was so convincing that I thought, did you go out into some of these spaces and record the actors in the space? And if you did, how did you get it so tight
right.
and so clean?
Well,
and
yeah.
So a really masterful job of really worldizing in an artificial way. But if the listeners don't know, there's kind of two different ways of attempting this. You can take a reverb, and I think anybody who's kind of opened up a program knows what reverb is. And you can kind of juice up and you can turn up reverb. And you can find reverbs that sound like rooms and stuff. But the difference here is you went into the actual space that you wanted it to sound like. You shot a bunch of noise out at the walls, came back, used that math to put into a plugin to then affect voices to be in the same space where you're recording some of your effects. That is like so next level design, and no one would ever put two and two together on that. And that's exactly what you're trying to attempt there,
right?
Is that you don't want anyone to ever think about it. And it's like so beautifully done.
Well, again, thank you. I'll tell you another trick that I did that this is the first time I've used this technique in sound design is I not only use one convolution, but I built a virtual room so that I have what the room sounds like when the characters are right up front and in the center. And then I have about four other convolutions, left, right, close, and then left, right, back. So I build kind of this quadraphonic send system where I can pan the characters around in this virtual room. So as they walk away to you into the left, they get more and more into the far left channel that sounds like the room from the far left. It's kind of fun. When you play back in the program, cause you can watch these little dots move around, as the characters do. One of my favorite.
So you're directing stage movement.
Yeah. It's blocking. Right.
Yeah.
One of my favorite moments when I, you know, realized that this was going to work is when President Johnson goes to make a drink and he tells a joke. And so he walks to the back of the room and starts making a drink. And while, you know, rambling on as he does, but it's like, it worked. I could hear the footsteps get farther away from us, the audience. They had the right tone. They didn't just like decrease in volume, but the reverb changed, their character changed. And then he came back, and it was seamless. And I thought, okay, this is how I'm going to do the entire series.
Well, I'm curious. I told you a little bit about our very quick kind of production cycle of how we start and kind of where we land. I'm curious what your production cycle typically looks like from beginning to end.
Well, I'll limit it to 1865 because with other podcasts, it's different. 1865. So, you know, the writers, Steve Walters and Eric Archila, they came up with scripts. And this was adapted from a play of theirs. Then we all read the scripts, but what we should have done is table read it. We didn't actually table read it. And I'll tell you why that was a problem. But I did read the scripts with an eye for, you know, or an ear for sound design, and made notations and sent it back to the writers saying this will never work in editing, or actually I probably said that a lot, but trying to get them to make small changes so that I have intros and outros and I know the scene is over and there's not miraculous heavy lifts required in the sound design. Then we just cast the characters. They're all local actors, and we brought them into the studio and started recording. We took about, you know, it depends on the scene. Everything probably got about 3 or 4 takes, and then we walked away with our first run at the series and began editing it. I had some help there. I taught. the other guys, the directors and writers, how to use our audio editing software a little bit. And they started picking and choosing takes and assembling things and, you know, gave me a crude edit back. And then I took that dialogue edit and started working. So after the initial phase of, which probably took me, you know, 4 weeks of not 8, 9 to 5 work, but, you know, working off and on, for about 4 weeks, I think I struck on the formula for how this is going to sound, and then we were cranking. I got one out a week, all the while also doing, you know, two other weekly podcasts. Back to the table read. What we should have done was work out some of the pacing and some of the dialogue, because it wasn't until, unfortunately, the edit where some of the glaring problems of our initial run at this thing became obvious. So enough of those errors piled up that we decided to do some re-recording. And so we had a big recording session in April of 2018. And then once we had a release date at the end of 2018, we did another recording session in October. And then for this re-release here this week in 2019, we did even more rewriting and jiggering up the end. So there, it is possible. In fact, I know there are sentences, single sentences in the show that have 3 different years of dialogue in them.
Wow!
Which is why I would want to record dry in a room. Because there would be no way to go back and edit if I didn't have that control. You know, if I had to like go back and find my historical location again, we'd be toast.
And that's the table read is something that we just started doing a few episodes ago. And I had learned that from working with another show. It was 99% Invisible again. Had done some work for them. And then I realized that they did table reads where you're literally reading the script from top to bottom. What I'll do is I'll read the narration. We'll kind of play the music. We'll either play the bites, or the producer will speak the bites, and then maybe have a small audience of people who's just listening as a listener. And what I've learned, just the more we go down the path, is like things need to be worked out on paper or Google Drive first. Everything is so much easier when things are so well thought out and crafted on the script first. And it's just something that kind of miraculously came to me recently. And it makes shows better. It brings more personality to it. The writers and the producers can hear me speak and hear me be clunky if something feels really weird in my voice. And sometimes I'll just be like, I can't say that, and this is the way it sounds. This is the way I hear it in my head. And then they'll rewrite it. The table read is just so key because it gets you so much further down the path when you actually go into the sound phase of things. And I couldn't recommend that enough. I think that that's something that is a little, it's a little part of the podcast world that gets kind of covered, or no one really thinks about it until the end, and you end up doing two or three times more work.
Yeah,
because of it.
Well, if you're interested in producing one of the high value, you know, production value podcasts, then put your effort in pre-production, because it will come back to bite you. And I don't think we'd ever attempt another audio drama without putting that step in. I mean, we learned a lot during terms, but that was a seat of our pants. We were recording and editing while we were publishing, you know, week to week. So, you know, we swore we would never do that again, and we didn't with 1865, but there was still room for more pre-production. And I totally understand how it gets ignored. You're anxious to put something out, especially when you don't have a normal production schedule, that, you know, a due date to hit. And, you know, you just want to get to the fun parts, and, you know, scheduling a meeting really isn't that fun, but it's worth it.
One thing that I don't do often, that you do often, that I'm kind of fascinated with, is your directing actors. Cause that's a real nuanced thing, especially to get the right tone. Cause, sometimes, actors are very trained on stage, mm-hmm. or where they have to be really big. Some actors are trained in animation where they have to be kind of overly animate, if that's a word.
Yeah.
You have, actors that are very much, like commercial actors, and you have actors who are very much wanting to be, you know, film, television types.
Right.
And so, with 1865 in particular, the thing that really kind of stuck out to me was just how authentic the actors sounded to my ears, and how natural they were. Can you tell me a little bit about how you approach that sort of stylistic thing? Because I assume that actors aren't just sitting down and it's done. There's a little bit of push and pull and stylistic
certainly.
Opportunities to tweak and get someone in the ballpark a little bit more.
Well, the very first thing you need to do is cast, you know, people like we got for 1865. It's 80% there once you get the right person behind the mic, and Jeremy Schwartz just did a fantastic job as Edwin Stanton. He set the bar, and it was hard for everyone else to catch up. One thing you also have to realize with this production, and probably most, is that, you know, the actors aren't off book. They're cold reading these scripts. Maybe they saw it the day before, but they're really just coming in and reading. Now, we have a lot of very good voice actors who are, you know, almost professional. Many are professional voice actors, but they do voice over for radio or TV, and they do animation. Dubs and things like that. And so both of those are completely different types of acting, as you mm-hmm. identified. So the real thing here is to get them back to acting and not presenting. You know, they're used to piling it on, and we need to peel it off. So having actors in the same room as much as possible, trying to make sure that they've got sight lines, that they're not afraid of the physical presence of the microphone, that they know that they can move and gesture. And in fact, please do, you know, all of these are rules that they've been given that break the rules from their previous engagements, you know, be still, no noise. So there is just a warming up period. But once they're in it, and we often tell them, this is film acting. You know, this microphone is a camera. You don't have to push too much. It does almost all the work. All you have to do is internalize the line. You barely have to put any emphasis on it. You know, even though we're not seeing your eyebrow raise, I swear to God, we're going to hear it. And so that's really the direction. Now there's some line reading, like I said, because these scripts are pretty much read cold. Some of the actors don't know where it's going, and the directors and the writers do. So they'll help out and go back and you know, explain some context. But mostly it's just to keep everyone in the pocket and emoting the best they can. The authenticity, the realness, the good performance is one that is just purely human. So we don't want to hear the acting at all. And so anything you learned in terms of a voice actor, an anime, or stage acting, we just got to get rid of.
Even going back to presenting, which I found an interesting concept, or you know, talking through that, I'm very much a normal person, sound designer, that has now wanted to get a lot of big ideas out to the world. And so through that, I've had to force myself in front of this microphone. And it's pretty incredible how hard it is to sound natural in front of a microphone, especially when you're kind of presenting information. And that's something that I've struggled with throughout time, and just getting comfort level with that. And I've taken voice lessons and spent lots of time practicing. And it's just pretty interesting how a microphone can kind of change your entire inflection and voice.
Yeah.
And all of these things. And even with podcasting, I find with presenting sometimes kind of sounds not very genuine.
Right.
It sounds very much like kind of overly scripted, which most of us are doing, is reading off of a script. But, you know, the biggest thing here is to try to pull this stuff off the script and really pull to a higher plane of human communication, especially human communication that's happening one millimeter from your eardrum. It just requires kind of like a completely different approach to be close to this listener.
Yeah. And I can hear it, you know, it's the falseness of the script. You know, even those narrators that are really good on NPR and others, I can still hear when the pause is too intentional, or, It's certainly something that I work on. I mean, I'm narrating 45 minute podcasts every week, and I'm reading right off the script, and oftentimes I'm reading it pretty much cold because I only got it the day before. It's hard. It is hard. I think, you know, like with most things, there is a muscle memory that happens when you get good at it. It's a detachment. You stop thinking about it, and it becomes just an action of the animal self. You know, particularly, you know, where the sentence is going, and you can give it a different contour, one that is more authentic than had you, you know, just read it out loud even 6 months ago. It's amazing what inflection can do, and speed and pitch. It's fascinating. But yes, presentation, I, you know, if you go back and listen to the very top of this interview, you're going to hear me more presentational than I am right now, because I'm very conversational right now because I'm in a conversation.
And you'll almost never hear me sound this informal, which I'd really like to get to. Like, I really want to sound conversational in my show. But you know, whenever when you work on something for hours and hours and hours, and written and all these things, and you've crafted every little word and all this stuff, and then you just want to really make sure that they sell, or the listener really gets it. It's just so easy to overdo it. And that's something that if I go back to my earliest episodes, we're at nearly 70 episodes right now. And it's kind of embarrassing to listen to the first few. I mean, a lot of people will say, like, oh, your first episode on Siri was like my favorite episode of all time. And I'm right. Like, I can't even listen to it.
Yeah.
I can't physically listen to it. Like, I'll put it on for some reason, and I'm like, all I want to do is just re-narrate it right now, and then go through about 40 episodes and just re-narrate all of it. But, you know, it's a process. And if you listen to any podcaster, like anyone that you've ever heard, go back to their early work and listen to it. And it's just a process of being comfortable, of learning how to communicate. And everyone, you know, all these podcasters still put this stuff, leave this stuff out for the world to find if they want to find it. They're still great stories, but it's kind of painful to go back and listen to early work.
Yeah, I do not go back and listen to my other podcasts too often for fear of that effect, because I will want to re-record it, and I know I just don't have the time. But good Lord, I've listened to 1865 more times than I've probably listened to anything. And at some point, it clicked. It sat in, and I was like, this is good. And so I think if there's a goal for the artist, it's exactly to feel that feeling. Like, okay, I don't hate it.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because it's not a process of like it clicks and then you work and work and work and work to make it better. It's a process of at least for us, about 2 weeks before launch on every episode that we do. It's the worst episode that we've ever done. Like clockwork, 2 weeks before every launch. That's the way it feels. And then it's about a week of kind of freaking out and, tweaking and like turning the screws and thinking about how we solve these problems. And then it's about a week before that it's just like, oh no, okay, this is getting better. This is better. This is better. Oh, it clicked. And now it works. Even just a word or a sentence and things can make an entire thing click. But I just love this industry where you can make this thing and you spend all this time. And then when it clicks and you've confirmed that it clicks and you've triply confirmed that it clicked, then you can push that out into the world. And it's going to be exactly what your intent was for, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, when they enjoy it.
If listeners are interested in sound design or just sound, then probably your podcast is a great place to start. So tell me what's coming up next and why people should tune in.
Yeah. So I will say that, first of all, everyone is into sound. They just don't know it yet. It is a fact. Something about our history, of like gatekeeping and stuff that says that only audiophiles can enjoy sound to the level of this, or audio engineers have the permission to have opinions on sound. And what I've learned through this process is that everyone loves sound, especially when you start to identify it. And so, if you love something like 1865, I think you're going to like stuff like this. We do a lot of history. Like we did an episode on Watergate, the Watergate tapes, in particular. We've done things on very specific sounds, like the voice of Siri, or like the story behind like that terrible emergency alert system. We'll do things on brain science, data sonification, the occasional musical motif, or like an occasional beat that's like this microscopic thing that we kind of explode. And then just all kinds of brain science. The one thing that I'm trying to do is just be real topical, real interesting, on a very global scale. Every single episode is completely independent of every other episode. So if it's something that sounds kind of cool, you can really just go to it, scroll. I mean, I would suggest tapping the subscribe button first. And then you can kind of just scroll. I am always partial to the latest episode that we make because it's just the ultimate level of our storytelling. But there's some, especially even recently, that I just adore. Sonic Illusions is pretty recent, and it's just really there to trick your brain. And there's multiple examples of where we trick your brain and you go, oh my goodness, I can't believe that just happened to me. If you're into Game of Thrones, I talked to the Game of Thrones sound designer, very personal, intensely emotional story of how she designed the sounds of dragons and things like that. It's a very intense listen. It wasn't as simple as what you might think. Voyager Golden Record, we talk about space a lot. I like that. And then Silly, we have a Silly episode that was called The Booge, which is all about this sound effect in trailers that you hear all the time that goes, and then you see a planet explode. So there's just tons of that. We're pushing episode 70 and with no end in sight. So go check it out.
Well, Dallas Taylor, host of the podcast 20,000 Hertz, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. And I am such a fan of yours. So this is so exciting.
Dallas Taylor is a sound designer and the head of DeFacto Sound, and also host of the fascinating podcast 20,000 Hertz, an exploration of sound in our world and in our lives. You can find 20,000 Hertz wherever you listen to podcasts, but I've also included a link in the show notes. Or you can just search for the words 20,000 and the letter H. You don't even have to know how to spell Hertz, and I bet it'll pop right up. Thank you for listening to this special bonus episode, and thank you for listening to 1865. We count on you, our audience, to like, subscribe, and share this show so that we can reach as many people who may enjoy it as possible. We also count on you for support. If you enjoy 1865 and want to see more of it, maybe a second season or spin-offs or historical audio dramas from other periods in American history, please go to 1865podcast.com and become a subscribing member. That's 1865podcast.com to pledge your support for what we're doing and to help us continue to make great shows. I'm Lindsey Graham, executive producer, sound designer, and composer of 1865. The series is written by Stephen Walters and Eric Archilla, directed by Robert McCullum, and includes a fantastic cast. You can find them and us on Twitter and Facebook at 1865 Podcast or 1865podcast.com.